You know, you could drop them. I think.
I think we can be heard.
No, I was talking about the lights. I don't mind the mics, though.
No, the lights are too bright.
Yeah. So thank you guys for coming out. For those who don't know me, I'm Pablo Hidalgo. I've been on the behind-the-scenes stage all day, all week, really. And I've got Jim Lucino here with me, Star Wars author. You know his works. You know. Thank you. This panel came together because Mary Franklin, when she was organizing the show, we were coming close to about 20 panels on this stage. Guys, feel free to come right up to the front. We were coming close to 20 panels on the stage. We were zeroing in on 20, but we actually didn't have 20, and that's a nice even number to wrap your mind around. So Mary asked me, like, hey, what do you want to do? Now, I have this unique perspective of celebration. I mean, I love doing the stage hosting stuff. But if I was here at the show, I always think, well, what would I want to go see? So this is my opportunity to say, if I had a panel, what would I do with it, right? So I understand this may not be the venue for this. This might have appeared on one of the smaller halls or what have you. But because I'm stuck here, I'm going to put it on this stage, you know. So I sense this. Yes, I sense this opportunity to do this. And I said to Mary, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to do a tribute to Brian Daly. And Mary, I'll let you in on something. Her email address, when I first met her, had the name Jessa in it. So I knew that she would be open to the idea. She's a big fan of those books as well. And we said, you know, we should get Jim involved in this. And to be perfectly honest, this is an absolute selfish panel because I've been wanting to talk to Jim about this for years, but I've never had the opportunity. In the interest of full disclosure, I never met Brian. Brian passed away in 1996, and my professional relationship with Star Wars began in 1995, and our projects never overlapped. I was appreciative of what he did, but I never did have the opportunity to meet him, to talk to him, to have any sort of correspondence to him. I suspect that since you're here, you've probably all been introduced to his work. Has anyone not read any of Brian's works? So, okay, great. So you all have some level of appreciation for it. And again, I'm fortunate to be joined by Jim, who is one of Brian's closest friends. So to start off with, I mean, Jim, can you talk about when you first met Brian, how far back you guys went?
Yeah, that photo should be destroyed. Brian and I met in probably 1974. He was recently out of a stint in the United States Army, and I was recently back from a couple years of sort of bumming around the world, traveling in Africa, traveling in South America and Asia. And our girlfriends at the time were both waitresses working in a restaurant, and They found out, lo and behold, they were both going out with guys who were working on their first novels. So Brian and I clicked immediately, and he was working on a book called Doomfarers of Coromon, which he sold. Well, I don't want to jump ahead if you want to.
No,
which he sold in 1976 to what was then a fledgling company called Delray Books. Judy Lynn Del Rey and her husband Lester, who founded this new imprint for Ballantine. And Brian was one of a select few to join the roster of Del Rey authors. Another of whom was Terry Brooks. So from that original roster, you know, you had two terrific writers. And it took me longer to sell my novel, which was not a science fiction novel, but an adventure novel set in South America. But if it wasn't for Brian's constant encouragement and Brian eventually introducing me to the folks at Ballantine, I might still be a carpenter. I don't know that I ever would have sold anything. So I owe a great debt to Brian, not only for his encouragement, but also his mentorship in writing, because I remember when I first read Doomfarers, the manuscript, I was astounded that this first novel could be so pitch perfect. I mean, it seemed like every word that Brian wrote was the perfect word. And Over the years, I learned a lot from him, and we'll get to that as we go through this.
So as we said, Doomfarer is a Coramon. It was published in 1977, and as we all know, 1977 was a very, very big year, particularly for everyone in this room, thanks to the release of Star Wars, and Star Wars would soon cross paths with Brian. Throughout this panel, I'm going to be playing audio clips of Brian talking, and it comes from an interview that he did with Derek McGinty in 1993 that aired on WAMU Public Radio. I want to thank Michael Kogi, who provided me this audio. He is one of the biggest Brian Daly fans that I know. By all rights, if he was here, he'd be hosting this panel as well, or co-hosting it. So if I'm assuming I do this correctly, we will start here and talk about the origin of Brian's association with Star Wars.
Judy Lynn Del Rey, who was running Del Rey Books, had bought the rights, the tie-in rights to Star Wars before it came out, which is, I guess, like buying a whole bunch of Xerox back when it was National, you know, whatever it was before right. That. Got in way below the ground floor. And I had sold my first novel to them and then my second, two fantasy novels, and I felt as though I wanted to take on some kind of work for hire to practice the craft a little. And that was at about the time Star Wars had hit. And Judy's stock was riding very high. She had told people that this was going to happen, and she proved it. So when I said, "Do you have any kind of work for hire I can do?" she said, "Pick someone from Star Wars and write me a book about them." And the reason I picked Han Solo was because he's the only one who really makes a moral decision in the course of the movie that changes him. Everyone else starts out bad and ends up bad, or starts out good and ends up good. He's the one who turns around in the middle of his departure and comes back. So I thought that it would be fun to play around with a character like that. First of all, I wasn't allowed to write books that took place after Star Wars. I had to go back before that for continuity reasons. Lucasfilm at that point, and this is very early on, didn't want anyone messing with the events that took place after the movie. And so what I was thinking was that these would be some of the adventures that would be going through his mind during that 20 minutes when he was gone. And obviously he's been flying along with his buddy Chewbacca, the Wookiee, the big hairy guy. And Chewbacca's got more of a moral conscience than he does, I think, and is probably jazzing him, going, you know you're not going to be happy leaving him behind.
Right.
Think about this that happened to us, and think about the time that happened to us, and, you know, all these things that you've said and done, and you're just a phony. You're not going to abandon these people. You couldn't live with yourself. So these are some of the things that happened to him earlier on. I see him as a really, as an idealist who's been disillusioned and perhaps betrayed. And
he's become cynical.
Yes, and he's taken on this armor of cynicism, as you say. He's become solipsistic in a way. But he does the right things for the wrong reasons in the books. Ostensibly, he's just looking after number one, but it always works out to something that helps the good guys. It's sort of like Rick Blaine in Casablanca, you know. Yes, I was a gun runner, but I made money. I was paid well every time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you were, but that's not why you really did it.
What you're looking at here is a piece of Chris Trevis's art from the upcoming Star Wars Essential Readers Companion.
Oh,
I
cool.
requested him to do a sort of posed publicity shot. If there was a movie attached to the Han Solo novels, what would you find on the Han Solo novels coloring book or something along those lines? There's kind of stills that happen as unit photography occurs, and I think he nailed it.
Brian, if I could just interject
sure.
this. It's interesting that To hear that interview, which I've heard before, and when was that done?
I think 93.
Yeah.
I think
okay.
Is what it
heard. So a lot of years had gone by, but really, Brian was almost on the edge of leaving that project altogether because he'd planned this whole story with Luke Skywalker before he even chose Han. He had all kinds of notions about these. These Jedi who had gone dark and a whole bunch of story arc. And then all of a sudden he finds out, no, you can't use the Force. You can't make reference to the Rebels. You can't do this. You can't do that. He basically had to create everything himself. And he was, for a period of time, he was really devastated. And he was ready to just say, I want out of this. Until he decided, okay, I'm going to find stories here. And that's when he began to think about Han Solo's past adventures with Chewbacca.
And it's so funny because that's exactly what really sets these books
that's
apart
right.
and,
yeah.
and makes them so distinctive, because we've had the Jedi stories now and the by not going with the supernatural or the overly mythic,
mm-hmm.
these novels seems to be much easier to connect to and, yeah. and enter into.
Yeah.
Here's some other additional artwork from the Essential Reader's Companion. This is from Brian Rood's series of character portraits. Each chapter beginning of the book is going to have what I called yearbook photos of some of the characters that were influential in their pertinent eras. We have Bollocks and Blue Max and Galandro. And the thing that I notice about Brian's works is he's one of the few authors that have made droids point of view characters. When you think about memorable droids in the expanded universe, there really aren't that many. We have 3PO and R2, of course, but even in the novels that exist, 3PO and R2 rarely are given the opportunity to really be 3PO and R2. And I'm not sure why. I don't know if, as an author, you could give some insight. I have some theories. I have some theories that there's a desire to give a strong point of view and a strong point of view of emotion, a strong point of view of motive, and trying to extrapolate that to a machine might be daunting, might be difficult. But if you look at the films themselves, R2 and 3PO do not behave like machines. They have very, very humanistic motivations. And that's exactly what Bollocks and Blue Max have as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Jim, if you have any insight about those characters.
I don't have any special insight to offer, but I do share Brian's... he'd like to take this point of view from everyone, you know, from bad, evil characters, heroes, and the droids themselves. And I've tried to do the same thing in some of my novels by introducing droids that have a point of view. I think it's very, very important for Star Wars. I mean, perhaps the whole saga is known through the droids, so I think it's really important to do that.
And also, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to read some samples or read some excerpts from Brian's works. And some of the things that I think make it distinctly his and also just make it distinctly ring true of Han and his attitude. Remember, we only had one movie to base this off of. And the question is, can you capture the tone of that movie and that spirit? You know, we understand that's difficult. It's what a lot of Star Wars authors have to deal with. But I just thought he did it in a manner that I thought feels effortless. So if you'll indulge me, I'm reading from Han Solo at Star's End. They had to do it in steps, of course. A hyperspace jump took them to an all-but-deserted, played-out mining world where the Authority didn't even bother to maintain offices. A lead there from an old man who had once seen better days put them in touch with the captain of a long-orbit ore barge. After some finagling, during which their bona fides were checked, with their lives forfeited if that check had turned up the wrong answers, they were given a rendezvous. At that rendezvous, they were met in deep space by a small ship's gig. When an inboard search by an armed, wary men revealed that the Falcon carried no one but her pilot and co-pilot, the two were led to the second planet of a nearby star system. The gig parted company with them as they came in for a landing, tracked by the upraised snouts of turbo laser cannons. The site was a huddle of quickly assembled hangar domes and habitation bubbles. Parked here and there was a wide assortment of ships and other equipment, much of which were gutted and decaying, cannibalized for spare parts. When Han stepped down the Millennium Falcon's ramp, his face lit up with that intense smile that had been known to make men check up to see what their wives were doing. "Hello, Jessa. It's been too long, doll." The woman waiting at the foot of the ramp looked back at him scornfully. She was tall, her hair a mass of heavy blonde ringlets, and her shape did extremely pleasant things to the Tech's coveralls that she wore. Her upturned nose held a collection of freckles gathered from under a variety of suns. Jessa had been on almost as many planets as Han. Just now, her large brown eyes showed him nothing but derision. "Too long, Solo? No doubt you've been busy with religious retreats, mercantile conferences, milk deliveries to the Interstellar Children's Aid Funds. Well, it's no wonder I haven't heard from you. After all, what's a standard year, more or less, eh?" "A lifetime, kid," he answered smoothly. "I missed you." Coming down to her, he reached for her hand. Jessa eluded him, and men with drawn guns came into view. They wore coveralls, fusion welders' masks, tool belts, and greasy headbands, but they were plainly comfortable with their weapons. Han shook his head mournfully. "Jessa, you got me all wrong, you see." But he knew that he had just received an explicit warning and decided that he'd better turn the conversation to the matter at hand. "Where's Doc?" The scorn left Jess's features, and she ignored his question. "Come with me, Solo." I'm going to skip ahead a bit as Han comes to Doc's empty office. He's the man that an old acquaintance from Han's past that he's come to visit. But he's not there. "Where's the old man?" Han asked, seeing the room was empty. Jessa slid into the comform lounger behind the desk. She clenched her hands on the lounger's thick, luxurious arms until her fingers made deep indentations. "He's not here, Solo. Doc's gone." "Well, how informative. I never would have guessed just from seeing the rooms empty. Look, Jess, I have no time for games. No matter how much you'd like to play, I know what you want." Her face was bitter. It took him by surprise. "No one comes to see us unless we know what they want from us. My father's not here. He's disappeared, and nothing I've tried has turned up a hint. Believe me, Solo, I've tried it all." Han eased down into the seat across the desk from her. Jessa explained. "Doc went off on one of his buying trips. You know, shopping for that stuff that would fit the market or for some customer's special order. He made three stops and never arrived at the fourth. Just like that. He, three crewmen, and a star yacht just dropped out of sight." Han thought for a moment about the old man with the work-hardened hands, a quick, crusty grin and a halo of frizzy white hair. Han had liked him, but if Doc was gone, that was it. Few people who vanished under circumstances like that ever showed up again. Luck of the draw. Han had always traveled light, and emotional baggage was the first thing to be jettisoned, and grief was far too heavy to lug around among the stars. This was a scene of two characters meeting, and there's just an economy of how much backstory is delivered by the amount of dialogue that's exchanged, and there's really not much dialogue. But in the way that Ryan positions it, you get the sense of the history between the characters, and you get instantly a sense of, you know, Han's point of view. And I just find that remarkable, and I think it's one of the reasons why I find his characters so memorable, because they make such strong first impressions.
Yeah, and I also think that this is a case of a writer being perfect for the material, because Brian was, in many ways, very much like Han Solo. to hear that dialogue, that's the way Brian spoke. I mean, he was so quick, so funny, and had that same kind of sardonic tone in his voice. Just used to crack us all up.
And which I find remarkable that his first place to start with might have been a Luke novel.
That's right.
Where it
that's
seems
right.
like that's
yeah,
that not...
it wouldn't have been right for him at all. I mean, that was just a perfect marriage of writer and material when he latched onto Han.
It occurred to me, I pressed ahead, and this is a slide that I just had. Just to illustrate the fact that as one of the first people to establish and work on Star Wars, Brian made an indelible impression in terms of building the world. He had one movie to work off of. And the inclination for some with that one movie was to make sure that there were X-Wing fighters in there and maybe, you know, things that you had seen in the films in order to reconnect with the audience. But instead, you know, he extrapolated. He built logical extensions. When his Z-95 headhunter appeared, it was not connected to the X-Wing fighter. It was just he figured if a galaxy produced an X-Wing and a Y-Wing fighter, surely it produced something that fit the bill of a Z-95. Or surely something like a swoop bike existed if you were able to extrapolate that from a land speeder. A friend of mine commented on my Facebook page, actually, when I was mentioning that I was doing a Brian Daley panel. He brought up a perfect example of you'd think an author would be inclined to throw name drop Tatooine or Banthas or things from the films, especially when you only have one movie to work on. And he didn't do that. And what's curious is now, when you have this enormous galaxy to draw upon, there's still that inclination of authors to name check Banthas and Tatooine, when in theory that's a planet that people don't go to, people don't mention in casual conversation. It'd be like doing a worldwide epic and everyone in the movie makes, you know, name checks Wichita for some reason, regardless of where they came from, you know, and he seems to avoid that. So again, with an economy of with a real economy, he built a very dense world just by really being selective with the words that he chose and the things that he established. So
yeah, and he was terrific at coming up with words like this. Once when he was writing, working on the sequel to Doomfarers, his editor at the time objected to one word like this that he came up with, and Brian responded with a list of 50 alternatives. So he was just bottomless in terms of what he could provide.
I've got another clip coming up here. We had talked about the humor and the spirit of the Han novels, and I think that's a big part of it. And I think he gives some indication as to where that may have come from here.
And in the case of Chewbacca and Han, there's always the reference to things like Terry and the Pirates, and these high-flying, hard-fighting guys. But in the case of these two, I think there's also a tradition that comes from Bing Crosby and Bob Hope from the Road Pictures, you know, just a couple of guys who have to use humor to get by a lot of the time. They have to make these wry wisecracks to each other, or they just couldn't, you know, they just couldn't get past it.
Hmm. One of my favorite descriptions, and I don't think it's doing it justice, but I understand the thought process that went through it. I was talking to Bill Smith from West End Games, who was their line editor at the time, and he and I were just geeking out because they were doing a Han Solo trilogy tie-in source book. And I said, wow, it's so great that you're doing this. And he likened the series to BJ and the Bear in space. That was that was his description of the Han books. But he meant that coming like from he meant that in the highest possible compliment. Yeah. So
Brian hated all of those titles, by the way. Han Solo at Star's End, he wanted to call the Millennium Falcon deal. And Han Solo's Revenge was going to be Han Solo's Transit, if he had had his way. And I can't remember what Lost Legacy would have been, but he was not happy with the choices that were made for the titles.
Interesting. On the subject of humor, I'm just going to have another excerpt. And it's the last one, so you're indulging me. I appreciate it. It's from the Lost Legacy, and Han and Chewie have come into a lot of money, or enough money anyway, that they're actually able to sit down and relax for a little while. They go to a university planet, the equivalent thereof, and they visit a spa. And Chewbacca has a luxurious spa treatment, and Han does what he does, and this is them about to leave. But they've been on this planet for a while. They've separated, now they're back together. Turning from the screen, Han noticed two very appealing young human females who were also waiting. One, a tall blonde in an expensive jumpsuit, spoke into the ear of her companion, a shorter girl with ringlets of brown hair. The second girl wore a sportier outfit of shorts and a singlet. She eyed Han speculatively. "Are you here to meet Captain Chewbacca, sir?" Mystified, Han repeated, "Captain Chewbacca. We saw him walking across campus, and we had to stop him and talk. We're both taking courses in non-human ethnology, and we couldn't pass up the chance. We've studied the Wookiee language tapes a little, so we understand a bit. Captain Chewbacca told us his co-pilot would be coming by to meet him. He invited us to go with you on a ground coach ride." Han smiled in spite of himself. "Fine with me. I'm Captain Chewbacca's first mate, Han Solo." He had just established that the brunette's name was Vior and her blonde girlfriend's Kylie when Chewbacca emerged from the treatment room. The Wookiee wore a beatific grin. His shaggy coat, now glistening and lustrous, floated lightly on stray air currents. Han sketched a sarcastic salute. "Captain Chewbacca, sir, I've got the whole crew standing by for orders." The Wookiee woofed in confusion, and then, remembering his assumed role, rumbled a vague reply that none of them understood. The girls promptly forgot Han and closed in on the Wookiee, complimenting him on his appearance. "I believe you ordered a ground coach, skipper," hinted Han. His partner a rude confirmation, and they all set off. "What have you found to be the essential differences in the life experience on Wookiee worlds?" Vayur asked Han earnestly. "The tables are higher off the floor," the pilot replied without expression. So again, it's that kind of. There's a way that he does this. Each of the three Han novels tread really close to the ludicrous, mm-hmm. but they never go over the edge to make it completely unbelievable. It kind of stays true to the character, and that's just something that I recognize as being very difficult, and I appreciate how well it's done. In Star's End, you know, Han's plan is to free a prisoner from a high-tech prison, and he ends up blowing the whole building into orbit. You know, on paper, trying to describe that sounds ludicrous, but it totally works in the novel. In Lost Legacy, there's a scene where they escape a horde of, you know, deranged lunatics by sliding down a mountainside on the side of a gong. And that is, like, perfect cinematic entertainment, as far as I'm concerned. And one of the things that I was talking to Jim about was, you know, reading the Han books again, I lament the loss of the 180-page science fiction novel as a viable form of particularly Star Wars entertainment.
Yeah. And those are the kind of books that Brian just devoured, books by Paul Anderson and some of the early Heinlein and Asimov novels. That was exactly what he was drawn toward. And he also had a very... He loved movies, and he tried to... make the books as movie-like as possible.
Yeah, we often hear in fan communities talking about things like oh, I wish they would turn X into a movie. But you really have to think about what it is you're asking for and take a look at the source material and ask yourself, well, would this make a good movie? And we all experience the same thing when a movie or a novel that we've all liked comes out as a movie, and we're like, well, that was different. That wasn't what I was expecting. And a typical example, I love the Thrawn trilogy. I love Heir to the Empire. But I don't think it would ever make that good a movie. Because if you look at the way it's plotted and the way the information is revealed in that book, it is basically built to work as a novel. The pieces of information that are gleaned together, the pieces that Thrawn puts together in order to solve his puzzles, it works so perfectly in text that to do that cinematically, you probably have to cut a lot out, rearrange things, eliminate characters, eliminate side trips that, again, as I said, be careful what you wish for. If you got that as an end product, would you still recognize it as Heir to the Empire? Is that what you would want, you know? Whereas the Bryan books, by virtue of them being about 180 pages, you look at the original Star Wars novelization, it ended up being 180 pages, and it's a very true depiction of what happened, translating the script into the novel narrative page. Bryan's books could almost wholesale be translated into scripts and largely work. And another observation I made is that they almost follow, they anticipate quite perfectly the template of Indiana Jones movies, and that there's a first initial quest that not only establishes the dynamic of Han and the type of character he is and the type of challenge he might face, but it has nothing to do with the end quest, but it sets him up really nicely. He resolves it, and as a result of something that he's carried from that first one, or maybe completely broken off, he goes and does the main plot of the novel. And that's really good. I mean, no one else has really followed that formula quite as well. And it's funny. It's like you could read a Han book and get an Indiana Jones experience out of it. One of my favorite sort of ludicrous moments is he holds an entire planet's economy hostage with a photocopier. I mean, that's essentially what happens in Han Solo at Glass Legacy. And there's something in there. There's a statement. There's a bit of satire, but it doesn't really hit you over the head with it. Mm-hmm. So, moving on past these novels to what a lot of people are probably familiar with, the radio dramatizations. In 1981, NPR began airing a 13-part adaptation of Star Wars written for radio by Brian Daley. He was tasked with taking the vivid visuals of the films and turning them into theater for the mind's eye. And as a side effect of the process, he ended up enriching the cinematic story of Star Wars and adding depth and drama to the characters. The radio drama, I think, really did a lot of favors for the character of Luke Skywalker. Luke fans, I don't know, I think Luke fans have it tough. He's not the coolest character to like. And yet he's the main star, and that's probably why, you know. It's like people like the underdog nature of Han, people like the bad guys, people like the novelty of the robots, but Luke is the earnest hero, and it's sometimes hard to give him the spotlight that he really should deserve. I think the radio dramas, out of all the sort of spin-off works, really do the best job of enriching Luke and kind of putting him in that position. I'm going to play another excerpt. This is a bit of a longer one. It's Brian talking about expanding the story of the film into radio, but using as a subject matter. He's going to talk about Luke, and this will include clips of Luke in action, and will also... I also tacked on an interview from Mark Hamill at the end, just to where he talks about his work in radio. So here we go.
I really was never at a loss as to how to expand on it. If anything, we had to cut stuff because there were just so many things to investigate. As you know, the series starts on the day of the space battle we see at the beginning of Star Wars, but we see Luke down below and see what his life is like. We see him interacting with his friends, and I think the most important part, and this was suggested by material that was cut from the script and from the movie itself, because Lucas, of course, had to edit that movie down. We see that he's, to a great extent, he's a misfit. Not that he's socially unviable or that he's not a capable fellow, but he's restless. He feels like he's a little different. And in short, I mean, he's like a lot of teenagers who think that there's something that's calling them. There's something they want to do, and it's not the same as what everyone else is doing.
Hey, boys, Guess what Skywalker was doing?
Hey,
sitting in the tech dome playing an Academy recruitment tape.
Not.
You never change, Skywalker. Is that all you want out of life, to parade around in a fancy uniform?
So what do you want that's so much better, Fixer?
Yeah, you watch it, boy. Just because you got lucky on a couple of crummy tests, that doesn't make you some kind of junior space explorer.
I never said I was any.
You know what I did back when they made me take those exams?
What?
I walked in, filled out my name, and walked out again. I showed him.
Yeah, just because he can answer fancy trick questions and do school book flight maneuvers, he thinks it makes him better than us.
Yeah,
Luke. So you happen to qualify. So what? What do you think you are, Biggs or something?
Yeah, he just wants to go to the Academy because Biggs did. He always was his hero.
Yeah, I'd like to go to the Academy. Why shouldn't I?
Because it's for some.
In the movie itself, his skyhopper, you perhaps wouldn't remember this, but his aircraft has been damaged, and that's why they go out in the little sand speeder. Well, in the first episode, we show him in that drag race and damaging the thing. He insists on sort of proving himself in a very dangerous air race. And part of the reason he's doing it is to uphold the honor of his friend Biggs, who's away at the Academy. Sorry.
Hey, you idiot, you took a wrong turn. You're headed for the Stone Needle.
Yeah, I bet we shaved 5 seconds off our time.
You're going to kill us both.
There's no going back now. Stay gripped, Wendy.
We made it. Wendy, open your eyes. We made it.
I'm alive. I don't believe it.
Hey, your stabilizer's gone.
Oh, I can hold her. We've still got to cross that finish line.
You'll crash us.
Here we go. I told you I could bring her in.
Hey, Wendy, we won! We won!
As soon as I heard about the idea of adapting the first Star Wars film as a radio show, I was very, very interested. Obviously, it is a labor of love. It's an opportunity for me to work in a medium that has been denied me simply because of my age. I mean, I've read so much about the golden age of radio and that whole realm of theater of the imagination, the idea of taking the first film, a two-hour film, and making it 13 half-hours is phenomenal. It's just, it's much more in-depth. It's fascinating.
The thing that I appreciate about that interview is it was done in 1981 before Mark had really established himself as a voice actor, and now hearing it in retrospect, you realize that his love for radio really has done well for him. You know, Jim, do you recall Brian's days of doing the radio work? What he was thinking at those times?
I remember that he had to write very quickly. That was the main thing. That he would just he disappeared into this. This house that he rented in the Catskills in New York, and just holed up in there and wrote these episodes one after another, only venturing out for beer and pizza.
The writer's essential tools.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Another thing about the radio drama, while it did build character, it also did serve the purpose of filling in logical gaps in the storytelling, and I've got a quote from Brian here talking about that, which also features a quote from Anthony Daniels at the end. So this is a bit of a longer clip, around the same length as the Luke one, but let's have a listen.
I just remember being a kid and coming on the end of radio and the first TV coming into our home, so I sort of had experience with that. And I had worked with radio in college. After I got out of the Army, I went to school on the GI Bill. So I had experience with doing radio, and I liked it a lot. And The advantage, I guess, is to get people in close into the story and see parts of the story that you don't get to see, because the movie just flies along. It just has to. And, for example, at one point, Luke and Ben Kenobi go into the cantina to find the man who turns out to be Han Solo, and they have to leave the robots outside. No robots allowed in here. And it occurred to me right away, well, here are these robots walking around, everybody and his brother is looking for them, and how do they lay low? What do they do? What would C-3PO come up with? And Eventually, what he and R2 devise is the plan of just walking over to the used robot lot across the street and standing at the end of the line. They don't quite put little price stickers on themselves, but more or less that's what they do, and they hang out there.
What? Imperial stormtroopers, where? They seem to be taking up positions to search the area. Come on, R2. We have to go and attract Master Luke's attention from the cantina doorway.
Watch it, Droid. Who do you think you're shoving?
I do beg your pardon, sir, but I wasn't shoving you.
And I say you were.
Go on, beat it before we take a wrench to your boat.
That won't be necessary, sir. Come along, R2.
Damn, Droid.
Looks like the stormtroopers are forming up for a house-to-house search. Our only recourse is to hide. What do you mean, what if we can't? How should I know? I'm not programmed for deception and suspect behavior like some that I could mention. You're the one that got us into all this. Why don't you think of something? Oh, look, more stormtroopers. We're trapped. What do we do? What do you mean I'm supposed to be the intelligent one? Wait. That used droid lot over there. Come on. When we get there, R2, stand at the end of the display line with me. Keep perfectly still. Don't make a sound.
Yeah, I like the fact that we got to show them using their wits, because Anthony Daniels, who plays C-3PO, is not only very protective of his role, he's also protective of R2. He wouldn't let anybody do anything with R2 that wasn't right and appropriate to the character.
Hey, what's this? Just what are you two doing standing there?
Well, our master instructed us to wait here, sir. He's canvassing the area to see if anyone wants any household maintenance jobs done.
Well, don't stand right here on my lot, you half-wit. People will think you belong to me.
Oh.
I got enough trouble selling these old clunkers without you hanging around confusing things. Now move!
Moving, sir. Come on, R2.
Sheesh. Darn pesky droids. There's not one of them has the brains of a womp rat.
Of course, when I did Star Wars originally on film, I had no idea what it would lead to in the end, all the kind of spin-offs and so on. But one of the happiest spin-offs for me was being involved in a radio version, because when I first started out as an actor, my very first job was actually as part of the BBC Repertory Company on radio. And I did hundreds of plays, you know, throughout years. And there's a whole history of that in England. And it was just natural for me to come and be part of a radio play here. Sadly, it's not part of the American kind of thing to have drama on radio, but this is a pretty good way of doing it, I think.
What's interesting is Cal Newman, who you know from Fanboys and Star Wars fan community, is actually doing a radio drama or the equivalent of an audio play. I'd love to see this form continue. I was hoping that online would somehow bring a resurgence of this as podcast fiction. I haven't seen an example of it, but I'm still hopeful that something like this could happen. Also, one of the highest compliments paid to Brian's writing is from Anthony himself. Anthony's very particular when it comes to 3PO, and he makes, you know, no qualms about even rewriting George's or the Clone Wars writers' dialogue in order to make it really fit as 3PO. But Anthony has been always complimentary about Brian's ability to really nail 3PO's voice. And, of course, we get to Han Solo. It's no surprise that Han would be well represented in the radio drama, given that Brian's past experience. I've anticipated myself. Before I move on to Han, one thing I want to mention was I had talked about how the novels benefit from the accelerated pace that follows, very much like the movies. But the radio drama slows things down, and if the films could be criticized for anything, it's that they don't, you know, one of the criticisms I heard is that they don't linger on emotions that much. And it's just the product of the type of style that they're emulating. Alderaan explodes. Leia, I guess, feels bad for a scene, and then she's back into action, telling people to get into the garbage chute, flyboy, and it just moves on. But by turning the Star Wars story into 13 half-hour segments, you have more opportunity to get into those type of emotional scenes. So here's a it's less than 2 minutes. Here's a version of a scene from A New Hope expanded to allow for the sort of drama and emotion that you would expect for that scene.
Thank you. Luke?
He just stood there, Leia. Just stood there and let himself be cut down.
Oh, Luke.
Why wouldn't he defend himself?
I can't explain it to you, Luke. The Jedi lead their lives according to what they believe the Force demands of them, and it's not always something the rest of us can understand.
But that still doesn't...
I know that Ben must have had some reason, some overriding purpose in allowing Darth Vader to take his life.
Vader? That was Vader who killed him?
Yes. He's the one who's been trying to recover the plans of the Death Star.
Vader killed my father. Vader betrayed the Jedi, and Vader's troops killed my aunt and uncle.
Luke, calm down.
Vader's taken away everything I ever had, and I ran from him. Don't you understand that? Vader took away everything I ever had.
Everything I had too, Luke.
Alderaan, your whole world destroyed. How can you live with that? How do you go on?
You find a purpose to justify the sacrifice.
Like Ben did.
Yes. Mine's to stop Vader and Tarkin and the Empire. I think that's worthwhile. What about you?
Yes. I do too.
So, yeah, it's quite a different feel to that sequence, and it's something that you imagine is in there. It's inherent in the characterization, but, you know, the films themselves are... If there is a reality to Star Wars, the films are, you know, one stylistic representation of that universe, and if you were to represent it as radio, that's the way it comes out as. I'm actually going to skip ahead because I think we've established the radio play quite well, and as we know, you know, in 1984... These were going to accompany a clip, but I'm just going to keep moving. In 1984, The Empire Strikes Back came out as a 10-episode adaptation, which featured, well, just like the first one, it was Perry King doing the voice of Han Solo. One interesting side effect is that I got into the radio drama much after. I never got to hear them the first time around. I heard them in the 90s when they came out in audio cassette from Highbridge Audio. And so I just completely overdosed on them. And it was the early 90s. It was this first, also at the same time that Star Wars publishing had really taken off. And I had found myself, because I'd been listening to the radio dramas nonstop, Han's voice in all the books as I was reading was Perry King and not Harrison Ford. And it works. Empire also had Billy Dee Williams reprise his role as Lando Calrissian. And I think he had, you know, again, in much the same way that the other actors' roles were expanded and the character was expanded. This expanded as well. This brings us to the point where, you know, 84 was when the Empire Strikes Back radio drama came out, and Star Wars disappeared rapidly after Return of the Jedi. It had moved off of a lot of people's radars, and likewise, there just wasn't much opportunity for Brian to be involved with Star Wars. There just wasn't much Star Wars going on. There was a Buena Vista book record of a little short story that explained one of the many versions of the Bounty Hunter and Order Mantell story that was out at the time, and Brian's work himself, you know, he continued his Coromant series. He established a different series with a new set of characters, but you know, if you were to look at the catalog of Brian Daley works, you'd think that, well, you'd expect a lot more to come out of that. And I've got an excerpt from the Derek McGinty interview where he kind of explains what he's been doing. So this is actually kind of fun to hear. Just the surprise on the interviewer's part. Hold on, I got to... Here we go. Oops.
Have you watched any of these Japanese animation that's come out in movie form at all?
Yes, and this is this might be the place for me to come out. People have asked about my rather low turnout in recent years, and what happened was James Luceno, my best friend, another Del Rey author and a mainstream novelist, he and I got together, and under the name Jack McKinney, we wrote the Robotech series.
No.
And the Sentinels. And,
really?
Yes.
I've seen those things in the stores. I thought they looked kind of, you know, for younger readers.
Yeah, they do look that way, and for your listeners who may not know, Robotech is about an 85-episode animated TV series, and it was very popular, and we were hired on to adapt Robotech as 12 books, which we did, and we tried to write them for older readers.
Really?
Yeah, I think we succeeded, at least according to the mail we did.
So you're saying I should go out and give them a shot then, basically?
Yes, everyone should buy plenty of them. They make great stocking stuffers at Christmas time. So buy several of each one.
So how did the identity of Jack McKinney come out?
Jack McKinney was actually a character in the first novel that I sold. It was a book called Headhunters. And Brian and I used to play around with our characters. I actually took a character from his Coromon series and wrote that character into Headhunters. And Brian actually took Jack McKinney and wrote Jack into one of his novels. So when it came time to do Robotech, we decided to just use Jack McKinney as our pseudonym. And it was interesting because for the years that we were writing that, there were a lot of theories about who Jack McKinney was. Everybody realized it was a pseudonym, and there were lots of different names of science fiction writers attached to the series. So this is where Brian revealed it.
And it went on to the Black Hole Travel Agency.
Yeah, we carried it on in the Black Hole Travel Agency, and then Brian moved on to back into his own work, and same with me.
I noticed that the Black Hole Travel Agency books are available online as ebooks now, but now you've separated the identity. It is actually credited.
That's right. Now it's credited to both of us in an effort to mine Brian's popularity, I guess. Yeah, they just came online. They're just came available within the last couple of months.
I encourage too. Also, all the non-Star Wars titles that I've shown in this slideshow are available as ebooks, and they're a great read. So please check them out. How did you divide the work when you're collaborating this way?
We devised an overview of the whole series, and then decided we were working on a really, really fast timeline. We had to deliver one book per month, and so we thought that the best way to do it was Brian would, because we had the animation, you know, we knew the story, and we could just wear out these VCRs looking at this animation over and over again. So Brian would take one book, I would take the next book, Brian would take the next book, and then as we finished our manuscripts, we would hand them off to each other so that I would go through his book. We tried to find like a unified voice. We found sort of a third, an other, that worked out really well because as you read the series, I think it's difficult to know sometimes that it was two different writers because we were constantly rewriting each other's material. It was an interesting collaboration.
So as I said before, this interview took place in 1993, and so if you look at the landscape of the Star Wars Expanded Universe at the time, the Zahn trilogy had just started, and there was a lot of question as to where Star Wars was at the time, what was happening. The response that I have here, or the quote from Brian that I have here, is in response to a call-in from a listener who wanted clarification as to whether or not these new books represent the real continuation of the cinematic Star Wars saga, which is a question that still shows up to this day. And Brian's answer is accurate, but there's something embedded in it, which I'm going to explore.
Recently, Bantam Books has started to issue novels written by a man named Timothy Zahn that take the story forward. Bantam, curse them, got the tie-in rights away from Ballantyne Del Rey in a bidding war. And I don't know how closely the Zahn books are tied to what Lucas actually plans to do with Star Wars. I tend to think that that the Zahn books are not going to be the blueprint that Lucas follows. And I understand from a friend at Bantam that someone else is preparing to do another trilogy. But I don't think that any book on the market right now really tells what happened, what will be depicted in those first three movies.
So if I were to speculate, I think he would probably be talking about Kevin J. Anderson because that's the next trilogy that came out after Tim. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I zeroed in on was the, you know, Bantam, darn them, got the license away from Del Rey. So in doing research for the Essential Readers Companion, I was pouring through a bunch of old files, and I came across this correspondence dated from 93 from Brian to Lucy Wilson, who was the head of publishing at the time. And there's a lot of interesting things embedded in there. I think what prompted this is that they finally got the go-ahead to do a Return of the Jedi radio drama. But in it, there's a specific correspondence or a specific section where Brian talks about the materials that he has. And the one that is so tantalizing was, you know, ideas for when Del Rey was potentially going to be the licensee that published Star Wars books in the 90s. And not to put you on the spot, because I understand there's no record of this on the Lucasfilm side, but do you recall?
Oh, I sure do.
Oh, boy.
I sure do, yeah. what happened was there was a woman named Risa Kessler at Ballantyne, who was in charge of licensing rights. And she and others at Ballantyne Books were not sure that there was a future in Star Wars, and they were really waffling about renewing the license. But they decided they were going to give it one more chance. And they contacted Brian, and they contacted me, and we were going to do the first of these spin-off novels. And Brian was going to write a series about the search for and the training of new Jedi. It would have been a very, very different direction than Tim went. And I was actually writing a book for them called The Tao of the Force, which was going to be a sort of a nonfiction exploration of the Force that was based on, it was going to be sort of excerpts taken from old Jedi texts that would provide lessons for the Jedi. And we came this close to getting those books out there. And in the end, Del Rey decided to surrender the license. Bantam picked it up, and Tim and the rest ran with it.
So that is an absolutely fascinating what-if scenario. You know, if things just went a little differently, just imagine how different the expanded universe would be today. That brings us to, let me ask you, was there a contractual limitation or a contractual reason why Brian would not be able to write for Bantam? Was he?
No, he was never asked.
Okay.
He was never asked. He could have. He didn't have any there was no exclusivity with Del Rey.
So we'll bring us to the subject of Return of the Jedi, where finally the opportunity came to finish the trilogy. As I said before, Star Wars came out in 81, Empire in 84, then nothing. There's a lot of reasons why, you know, the waning popularity of Star Wars is one of them, but also changes in government funding to National Public Radio affected the chances of doing something like a radio drama. But things changed in the 90s, where there was a viable market for this stuff, especially after broadcast, as audio cassettes or CDs, and Star Wars was once again a hot topic. So Brian returned. He wrote what it ended up being, I think, a six episode. Or it should say right on there. Yeah, six episodes. Yeah. Good thing it's on the slide. Six-episode adaptation, shorter than the others. And not, unfortunately, because they lost the momentum of the first two, we weren't able to get Mark Hamill to return to the role of Luke Skywalker. A new actor played him. Same with the situation of with Lando. Billy Dee did not play him. But Anthony returned as 3PO. Perry King returned as Han Solo. And Anne Sachs returned as Princess Leia. And again, it has a lot of the same feel and a lot of the same fun of the first two. I want to play just one clip from Jedi. And the reason I want to play this one, because it's particularly relevant to Celebration 6, there's a piece of artwork that was created for Celebration 6. The instant I saw it, I was reminded of the scene. So this is after the rescue from the Sarlacc pit.
Huh?
Just making it easy for you. You are sitting there trying to figure out a way to thank me, aren't you?
I was getting to it. I was getting to it.
And?
Not a bad rescue for a princess.
Compared to yours, you mean? How well planned the Death Star foray was, for instance.
Well, you're not in that detention cell anymore, are you?
You're not in that carbonite slab anymore, are you?
All right.
And while you're replying in kind, what about the last thing I said to you in Cloud City? Just before Vader froze you?
Well, a lot of that's kind of blurry, Leia.
Never mind. It'll come back to you.
It looks like we're about ready for the jump to hyperspace.
Well, I'm sure you can handle that. So if you'll excuse me, Captain, I'm going to go find some clothes that don't require a cabaret permit.
Huh? Hey, Leia? Are you going to throw those ones away?
I heard that scene in my mind the second I saw Chris's art. I'm like, and I need to ask him whether or not that factored into it. I mean, it's a logical scene to extrapolate, but I thought Brian nailed it in that execution. So this takes us up to the mid-90s, and by which time, Brian was ill. And finishing Jedi was a challenge for him. I'm not certain how the work was delineated, but I know John Whitman did a lot of work in helping to flesh out Brian's scripts, just because, you know, he couldn't finish at the time, or he wasn't able to complete it to the level that he needed to. I suspect, and I don't know this for a fact, that it was John who inserted a lot of the contemporary expanded universe content that's in the radio drama, things like Mara Jade appearing in the shadows, and references to Shadows of the Empire. Forgive my editorializing, I think that's a bit of a detriment to the Jedi radio drama, because the nice things about the first two radio dramas is they really stand alone and they really feel like extensions of the movie, whereas the Jedi one felt a little bit more like an expanded universe project, you know. But still, he finished the trilogy, and the crew and the cast knew that Brian was not well, and so they recorded a get well message for him when they finished recording. And I have an excerpt of it here. It's the original was about 5 minutes. I cut about a minute only because there's a couple of references that are really contextual to the show itself, and it wouldn't necessarily make sense here. There's one that I left because somebody makes a reference to a joke line that Han makes to a Gamorrean guard, and it's very Han, where basically Han calls the Gamorrean guard's mother a matched set of luggage, which is a good Han Solo Gamorrean guard insult. So that's in there, But here's the recording that the cast made as tribute to Brian.
Leia Organa, transmitting to Brian Daly on Earth. We seem to be having a bit of a time warp here. Luke seems to be shedding years as he matures into a Jedi Knight.
Leia?
And
Leia?
Han?
Are you talking to Brian?
Uh-huh.
You love him, don't you?
Well, yes.
Fine. I understand. When he comes back, I won't get in your way.
Han? He's the writer.
The writer? Then you weren't... Well, but then Brian isn't...
Why don't you just stop worrying about Brian and kiss me?
R2, prepare to lay a course in the Nava computer. What, my part? No, it's fine. I just took over for another actor. No, it doesn't hurt. I don't let it. Okay, course plotted. Get ready to jump into hyperspace. That's right, we're going to the Baltimore system. I have a promise to keep. To an old friend. Look, actually, I've never met the guy, but you think I'm going to pass up an opportunity like this?
Okay, I just want to do one pickup, Tom. Can we just go, please, from my mother's a set of matched luggage? Stand by.
Hi, Brian.
Okay, cut, thanks.
Great. Greetings, Brian.
I kneel before you and await your orders to execute your wish. Brian, this is Brock. Get well. Rejoin us soon. Love.
R2? R2-D2, what are you doing here in an empty studio? Rehearsing for your next scene? But R2, we finished recording The Return of the Jedi. Oh, don't be sad, R2. We had a lot of fun, didn't we? And all because of Master Brian. Yes, I think he did an excellent job, but... Well, I think he gave you rather too many lines. Just you watch your language. Oh, that is a good idea, R2. Let me see. Hello? Ready? Master Brian, R2 and I want to say that it has been a distinct honor and a joy to work with you. With our thanks, we send you our very best wishes. There. Though you can't have another retake, R2. Oh, trouble with you is Hollywood has affected your circuits. I'm ridiculously starstruck.
So the crew recorded that after finishing up Jedi, and it was delivered to the hospital where Brian was staying, and sadly, he passed away. He never got a chance to hear it. He passed away that night, but as the optimistic way of phrasing it is, he didn't get a chance to hear it in this world. Everyone involved knows that Brian knows how much he was appreciated by everyone involved in the project, and that's where... He left us as far as his Star Wars contributions go. So I want to thank you all for indulging me. I mean, I'm a big fan, and this is a place to be a fan, and I wanted to share this with you guys. I wanted to have an opportunity to talk to Jim about it. I was glad he was able to offer information that I never heard of regarding the what could have been at Del Rey. And we are wrapped here, but if you guys have any questions, I'm just going to come down and talk to you guys. We're going to strike here in the meantime, but go ahead, ask, and thank you all for coming on. Actually, I see Ryder has a question.
Is it too late for a reboot at Del Rey?
I'm not the person to ask that here. One thing I wanted to point out was a project that Ryder was involved with. One of the last things that Brian contributed was a plot to a comic series or a comic story that he developed, I believe, with Anthony Daniels. And Ryder expanded that into an actual script, into a story that became The Protocol Offensive, a one-shot C-3PO story. Did I get that right, Ryder? Yeah. So.
I just want to give you the toast that Brian always used to raise every time we sat down to open a bottle, which was, to our noble selves, damned few of us left.
Clear skies. Thank you all. If you want to stick around for a bit, we're going to be striking the set. I'm going to hang out for a little bit if you guys want to talk. So keep having a great celebration if you're going off elsewhere. So thank you.